Hi, Topcast listeners. Here is a quick, time-sensitive opportunity for you. We are soon to host our very first official online Topcast meetup with other Topcast listeners, Topcast hosts, and our behind-the-scenes Topcast team. Please mark your calendars now for August 24th, that's a Thursday, at 12 o'clock noon Eastern Daylight Time in the United States, which is -4 UTC for you international folks. Mark your calendars and join us for a good conversation. You can give us input and find out more by going to the following URL, bit.ly/poll topcast meetup. Poll, P-O-L-L, topcast meetup. All lowercase, no spaces. From the University of Central Florida's Center for Distributed Learning, I'm Kelvin Thompson.
And I am Tom Cavanaugh.
And you're listening to Topcast, the Teaching Online podcast. That's the jazz hands version of the intro.
I was going to say, the listening audience doesn't, they can't see the jazz hands happening here in the studio.
How are you doing, Tom?
I'm good. I didn't know we were in the musical Chicago all of a sudden.
It's a thing.
Yeah. Cool. I'm well. How are you?
I'm gonna be doing a little bit better as I pour my coffee here. I already poured yours.
I hear the dulcet tones of coffee pouring like a waterfall in a tropical rainforest.
Dulcet tones.
So what are we drinking today? What's in this thermos?
Well, okay, so here's the thing, right? So here's backstory today. So as you know, it's been my practice, not a hard and fast rule, but my practice to bring in freshly brewed, freshly ground, freshly roasted, high-end, usually single origin coffee for our little episode recording days, right? And I think you know this, because I think we've talked about this before, green coffee beans can be stored really kind of indefinitely. And there's kind of industry consensus among roasters that you really should, for the best taste, grind and brew about 2 to 3 weeks after roasting. So a lot of your high-end places, you might see on your coffee bags, it'll even have like a kind of like a born-on date, right? It'll be, oh, it was roasted on Thursday, February 16th or whatever. And so you can kind of track that. Or at least you can ask the person, hey, when was this roasted? Oh, yeah, last Thursday, whatever. So that you can keep track of it. So here's the deal. I've got like a true confession because I'm mildly embarrassed that the stuff that I've served you today, it was roasted several months ago.
Gasp.
Not my normal thing. So after this, we might have to institute a firm policy requiring specified roasting freshness because it could be crap. So I'm scared to ask, but I'll ask. How's the coffee?
It's good. I don't know if it's my delicate palate, but it seems stronger than what we usually drink. Is that true?
What I think it is, this particular coffee, which is an Ethiopian Harar from Java Junction in Brockport, New York, because our colleague and Geralico Perlman from the college at Brockport was kind enough on a recent visit to shuttle me around all over the place, including her favorite little coffee place, this Java Junction. And they roast right there on site. And the guy behind the counter told me that they do kind of roast a little dark. And this stuff's a little extra darkly roasted.
Yeah.
And I've been having to play with the brewing to try to offset that a little bit. And I don't think I did as good a job with the with the French press offsetting it, but so I think that's the boldness that you're getting.
That's all right. I will have my eyes wide awake on my drive home.
Yes, sir. That's right. So I don't know, Tom, but could you find somewhere in that long rambly trail a connection to today's topic?
Of course I could, Kelvin. So you mentioned that there's no hard and fast policy about when the roasted beans should be ground and brewed, mm-hmm. and you are thinking of mm-hmm. instituting a firm new policy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What is the common thread there?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about policies, everyone's favorite.
But don't turn off the recording
yet. That's right.
Don't let that stop you from listening to us.
Yeah, because trust us, it's actually a little more interesting than you might think. I hope.
Topcast.
We are not policy wonks. We are not wonks of any stripe, I hope. It's just fun saying the word wonk.
What is a policy wonk?
Yeah, people who kind of make their business policies,
I don't know. I think you lean that way more than I do.
I think that's probably true. It might be just an occupational hazard, too, for how I spend my time. But it's no denying policies are important, and they influence us every day in the work that we do, certainly not just online, but in higher education in general and all education in general.
So is it me, Tom? It seems to me that policy, that word, gets used in all kinds of different ways. Can we maybe unbundle that for a second?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll start with an example here.
Okay.
At UCF. So we've got, like all institutions, a set of policies. But that has a very specific defined meaning. If we have a policy, it's gone through a formal policy development and review process. It's signed by the president of the university. It's published in a policy location. And we were talking about, when I first got to UCF a number of years ago, creating or updating our distance learning policies. And they have mostly to do with our expectations for faculty development and what our modalities are and some of the things that, that kind of level set distance learning across the university. But we realized that they didn't meet the threshold of an institutional definition of a policy. We certainly weren't going to ask the president to sign some document requiring faculty development or something like that. So we had to change it. We had to change the name of it, and it's on our website now if anybody's interested, and call them guidelines.
Guidelines.
Yeah, I keep thinking of the Pirates of the Caribbean movie. They're guidelines, really.
A code. So, yeah. We have a code.
They're more guidelines.
That's right.
Yeah, so we call them guidelines and not policies, but we treat them like policies. We try to enforce them like policies if we can. And so we had to kind of walk that tightrope of policy, guideline, but all of it has to do with managing the kinds of activities and behaviors that we have here at UCF.
Yeah, so is this right, or at least fair, that I think we might even use policy in kind of a gradation kind of a sense, right? A little continuum sense, that there's like guidelines or procedures, and sometimes we say policy. There's like rules, regulations that have a little bit more force.
Yeah, and here those mean different things.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then there's like laws, statutes, you know? And then like in the news, you might, you know, policymakers today determined that, you know, or whatever, and they mean lawmakers, which they mean legislators.
Yeah.
Usually.
But then there are well, maybe we should start with that sort of strata you talked about.
Yeah.
So we have federal or national policies and laws and regulations, and that could include maybe regional accreditors, but the feds, the Department of Education, Department of Labor, whoever. We have state-level boards and legislation that kind of govern us within our own state jurisdictions, and then each institution or maybe a system or something has their own policies and regulations that people have to kind of abide by. And each of them kind of has a place, and it's not a hard and fast rule, because I've had many conversations with colleagues who've asked me about our policies, and they have, in fact, placed the kinds of things that we are calling guidelines into formal policies that do get signed by their institutional president.
Right.
I think you run a – there's a pro and con to that. The pro is that you have the weight of the institutional leadership behind it, and it's enforceable clearly. The downside, the con, is that you can get so granular with those things that you just can't keep up with it. Stuff changes. The policy changing process is not nimble. So I think you kind of have to weigh that if you're going to try and decide to codify something into a policy.
You'd be outdated or
exactly.
hard to change, not nimble.
Like, we just added a modality this year
to
our list of modalities that we've had for a long time. And we needed to do that fairly nimbly because we're trying to support an innovative project. And I don't know if we could have done that quickly through the policy process.
Yeah, that makes sense. So for this episode, for the remaining few minutes that we're here together, how are we going to operationally define policy, would you say? Or at least frame it.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe we should just talk about the those levels. Mm-hmm. Maybe even a couple of examples from some of those levels. So if we look at the, maybe we'll start from the broad to the narrow, at the national level. And as I said earlier, you and I are not policy experts. No, no. If you want to know about policy, please call Russ Poulin at WCET.
His number is.
Yeah. Russ knows, I mean, he'll forget more than I ever know about policy.
And I guess as a little shout out to them, right? They will periodically from WCET, from Russ, they'll send out little, I think I got one not long ago, policy updates and like relevant stuff happening in Washington, D.C.
And I sleep better at night knowing Russ is out there protecting us. Yeah. And there are other people. Jarrett Cummings at EDUCAUSE does a great job. His purview is a little broader than just online learning, but it includes it. But there are some people who are really expert in this area. And if you're interested in it, they each publish like blogs and they have newsletters and other kinds of updates that I would encourage you to subscribe to. But kind of writ large, you know, we are influenced by things like, well, let's just take one example here, federal financial aid policies, the laws and the kinds of reporting that we have to do to stay compliant to receive Title IV funding, in some cases has made it really difficult to do some types of innovations. So when we're looking at things like, we're not doing competency-based education, but we're experimenting in those areas. And I know that there are mechanisms for experimental sites and for, you know, crosswalking competencies to credit hour. And there's all kinds of things that can be done. But we are not an experimental site. And it can be really problematic when you've got somebody who's running financial aid who has a particular job to keep us out of trouble and to make sure that students get the money that they need in order to get the education that they need. Sometimes those forces can be in conflict. And when you and I are trying to push the envelope on some stuff, but Tom, did you realize that what you're proposing is going to negatively impact satisfactory academic progress and students aren't going to get their money and we can get in trouble? I'm like, well, no, I didn't know that. That's why I invited you to a meeting so you could ruin my plans. So policies in that regard can sometimes make it really hard or can you know, nudge you in certain areas.
So how about this as a pause for a second? How about, so I'm just checking in with you. So policy, at whatever level, policy can drive our behavior. Policies can be perceived as positive or negative. Right, you could have, you could see policy as an obstacle, like you know, you just described, or as something to figure out over, under, around, or through, and something to respond to, checks and balances. Whatever.
Well, I mean, look at just the regional accreditors, for example. They ensure a certain level of quality and financial, stability for institutions and governance and all those other things that are all good.
Right. So some policies we are looking for policy to be enacted because it's going to bring about some desirable outcome. Well, somebody needs to take a stand on this, and so if it's made, then you know it's good for all of us. Maybe
some that kind standardization, of thing. Perhaps, or something. Yeah.
And so in policymakers, brewing policy, even it's probably in our best interest as online education professionals to be as aware early in the process as possible, right? So that we can respond, kind of shift our sails, whatever. Maybe even we can find ways to influence policymakers so that they're informed. I mean, I know when we were first planning TopCast, we even envisioned, perhaps fancifully, but envisioned that well, maybe we'll have these TopCast episodes and they'll find their way to the ears of folks at our state legislature and they'll be more knowledgeable about online education and make really great decisions for us.
Yeah, let's hope. Maybe that could still yet happen. yeah, that's true. In many cases, our state legislators and boards of governors and others or whatever your system or institutional governance is, they are as susceptible to media hype as anybody else, and they are the ones who enact policies to try to accomplish certain things or avoid other things from happening. Mm-hmm. As you said, I think that was a good definition. They try to influence behavior mm-hmm. to get institutions or individuals to do or not do certain things.
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about the federal or regional accreditors. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got particular rules around, if we're talking about competency education still, mm-hmm. around, you know, direct assessment and other kinds of things. And they're just trying, for them, it's to ensure that you don't compromise the quality of the education by doing some of these innovations and experiments. At a state level, we've got a number of things, just for example, in Florida, that I think might be good examples. For example, we've got the distance learning course fee, which is defined in statute.
Yep, right.
And institutions around Florida can charge a fee to students to cover the additional cost associated with putting something online. It doesn't cover anything that you would have paid otherwise in order to deliver a course had it not been online. And that's been a real useful revenue source for most schools in the state to try and grow online learning. And I think in some ways it explains why Florida has such a high online learning adoption. But there has been changes to that legislation in recent years. They have capped the amount. Fortunately, it hasn't impacted us, but it has impacted some of our sister institutions. And there's always talk about, you know, further revising that, which makes us nervous. So, like, if the fee went away,
That'd be bad.
Well, yeah. What does it mean? It would change our
whole lot of bake sales.
Yeah, we'd start turning over the couch cushions. And, yeah. No, I mean, it would just change our business model.
Yeah.
We'd have to adjust.
Right.
You know? But so that's a big policy one. There are other things that are maybe a little broader in the state of Florida. There is performance-based funding. So the schools are being rewarded for achieving certain performance metrics, such as retention, graduation, certain kinds of SAT score, whatever the case might be. And that has changed behavior at institutions around Florida.
Oh, yes.
It definitely has. And it has trickled down to us. It's not just sort of at the big, you know, macro levels, but it kind of filters out the institution. In the state of Florida, there's also this thing called preeminence, which is a drive to have the institutions kind of move further up the Carnegie ladder. And in the rankings, we have two schools, Florida and Florida State, that are currently preeminent to others, UCF and USF, that are climbing. We are emerging preeminent. But there's millions of dollars associated with that if you can work your way up those ranks and achieve the metrics that have been laid out. And as a result, we are trying to achieve those metrics. And so institutional resources and energies are being pointed at these things, performance metrics, preeminence metrics. And in the past, maybe we wouldn't have put as much an emphasis on all of those things.
Right. So if you're a policymaker in the state of Florida, and of a policymaking body, the legislature, perhaps influenced by other bodies like, in our case, the State University System Board of Governors, if you want to see some desirable outcome, then you kind of carrot and stick it, right? That's kind of where the policy thing comes from. Like, you're going to have some money on the table, some status. If you do these things, then you get a certain status and there's money associated and so forth.
The performance funding formula has changed pretty much every year to some degree or another. But in the past, it has even had some punitive measures to it, not just
there's the stick.
Reward. Yeah. And so that it gets serious when you're talking about your institutional budget or other resources. So yeah, it's been a big deal. And I think it's an example of how policies can change large institutional behavior.
Just a comment, you know, back to the DL fee thing for a second, the distance learning course fee. I've always found it fascinating that the statutes related to that, you rightly pointed out the financial aspect of that and the funding aspect. I've always been fascinated by the fact that as a means to an end, in the state of Florida, we've codified what distance learning course means.
Yeah.
Because in order to count which credits get this fee and so forth or eligible for it, you've got to be able to recognize it.
Right.
And so you get like the whatever
80% or more online is an online distance education course, and less than that is not. And so when we, in our world, even at a faculty development level or a course development level, are working with faculty to design and develop courses, all that has implications for whether we consider it blended or fully online, and the pedagogical things. So something as simple as, I mean, it's not simple, right? But something as, because a lot of us, I think, like, well, whatever happens up there at the state or the national legislature, that's up there. You know, that doesn't really affect me. But all this stuff affects affects
us. Yeah. Well, another example that is near and dear to your heart is this quality initiative that is happening at the state.
Yep.
So there was a distance learning task force that created some strategic recommendations, and there's an implementation plan, and all of the various universities around the state are helping to enable this implementation plan related to some strategic goals around online learning, which include student credit hour goals and some other things.
Yep.
But one of those implementation tactics has to do with quality.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been serving on that committee and now in a co-leadership role on that committee. And they have defined some, as you said, carrots, some like recognitions, including awards and special kinds of like, you know, good housekeeping seals of approval on high quality and quality courses. And in looking at that, we have, pardon me, we have tried to align our internal quality initiative to be consistent with what's happening at the state level. Not that what we were doing was bad, but it might have been just slightly parallel, not exactly aligned. But because of what's happening at the state and some of these what will become policies come down the line, we want to be ready for it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good example for sure. And I guess it's also an example of there's things that at the state level that we talk about the state legislature, but then we have other bodies, like in our case, the Board of Governors. And then in the case of the quality thing, there's a strategic plan for online education that was ginned up by a committee under the oversight of the Board of Governors, and so now we're carrying all that out. So it's policy of a sort, but it's not enacted in the halls of the legislature per se. But it's still going to drive behavior, we hope, in a positive way.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then maybe the last area to talk about is at an institutional level, the institutional policies. You know, once the state level policies that we're talking about, in fact, even the national policies. So if we talk about financial aid and we talk about distance learning course fee, performance funding, preeminence funding, I heard someone say one time, I doubt this was original, that the way you herd cats is you control the cat food, right? So if you want to control the cat food in the higher education world, it's the funding. Each of those things controls the funding, access to funding. And I've seen the same thing play out on campus. Once upon a time, we had a funding model that rewarded departments and colleges for doing certain things. If they did any one of them, they received, I think it was a 15% budget plus up based on credit hours. And that included things like service learning and I don't know, I'm drawing a blank on some of the others, but one of them was distance learning. And that was a way to kind of get it off the ground. And if you did those things, you got a reward, a financial reward for doing it. And so it was an incentive that was put into a policy that had funding associated with it.
That's good. Is it worth mentioning anything about the U.S. national level, SARA? I mean, I don't know if we consider that policy or not, but
yeah, that's a good one. You know, probably because each state has some law associated with distance learning or even, you know, operating within that state. So you have to be authorized. And so in that regard, SARA, the State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement, NC-SARA, tries to translate between all of these various state rules and regulations and create one sort of passport for everyone that mm-hmm. everyone recognizes. The analog is a driver's license.
Yeah, right.
So your driver's license is issued by a state, and I have a Florida mm-hmm. driver's license, but I'm allowed to drive in Georgia and in Texas and in Alabama if I want to. They recognize it. There's driver's license reciprocity. And so what they're trying to do with NCSERA is do the same thing for all of the various rules and regulations in each state, allowing people to serve distance students there.
And of course, you know, this is where I get out of my depth real quickly, right? That, again, driving home this point of policy isn't necessarily from an elected lawmaker kind of a position, right? Because the SARA stuff, that state coordination that you've talked about, happens through the four U.S. educational compacts, and then NCSERA as a national council seeks to kind of work within those four compacts and the 50 states, and but it's not happening from Washington in the sense of like the Congress or something. It's happening in this other body.
No, although at one time their Title IV funding was threatened.
Yeah.
So if you were not compliant, you potentially would have to forfeit Title IV funding if you were found violation of serving students in a state you're not authorized. Mm-hmm. And that got everybody's attention and kind of was some of the genesis behind the push for something like SARA. But you're right. It runs from an institution to a state coordinating council to the regional compact to the NCSERA headquarters out there down the hall from Russ Poulin. Mm-hmm. Marshall Hill runs it. And so far it seems to be working. Mm-hmm. So fingers crossed. I'm a big proponent of it personally.
Well, I see that our coffee's low and our clock is ticking away. This is a complex issue. I knew going into it, it was going to be like, oh my gosh, policy. But let me take a stab at bringing it home for us. So keep me on the road, Tom. So policy, whether we're talking about the institutional level, nationally, anywhere in between, accrediting bodies. Educational compacts, whatever. Policy drives behavior. So as online education professionals, it's in our best interest to stay current on relevant policy. And again, maybe as early in the policymaking process as possible. I'm not necessarily saying that we should have picket signs and go outside, but be involved somehow in the process. And maybe we can even look for ways to provide input to policymakers so that we, as online education professionals, can influence the policies that in turn influence us.
Yeah, well said. I think that in many cases there is innocent ignorance of online learning by many in positions of policymaking.
That's a good phrase. I like that. I want you to say it again because I liked it.
Well, when you say ignorance, I don't mean it to sound pejorative.
No,
that they just
don't know.
Yeah. It hasn't been their personal higher education experience to take online classes. Many, I would hazard to say most legislators have gone through a traditional four-year type experience and aren't used to the kinds of online learning techniques, technologies, pedagogies that maybe more non-traditional students would be requiring, the kinds of students that we serve.
Yeah, that's
so
fair.
Helping them understand this experience that might be completely foreign to them so that they can formulate policies that serve the constituents that they want to serve. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good thing to try and to be a partner to them.
That's great. And so here's some homework. We don't often give homework on Topcast, but here's some homework. If you, Topcast listener, know a policymaker at any level, perhaps you could share this and other episodes of Topcast with them. Or if you know somebody who knows a policymaker, maybe you could, you know, subscribe to Topcast on their phone for them or play it for them or give them a link to the website, topcast.online.ucf.edu. You know, it's all in our best interest to be informed and informed others.
Yeah. Is that fair? As you said, there's a ton of stuff. We are not the experts, but there will be a lot of links in the show notes.
Yes.
And if you want to go deeper, there's plenty of opportunity to do that.
That's right. So until next time for Topcast, or maybe even for Topcast, I'm Kelvin.
I'm Tom.
See ya.